Are you making that bird sound?
I'm not making that bird sound. The bird is making the bird sound.
Ah, clever. Meanwhile, about this time each year, that is, halfway between the third Wednesday Pluperfect and the second coming of the Calandra's War, the research and development branch of Calvo's Ampersand Damien's
In the house
Club is asked this question.
In the house party. Nobody will remember that. It's an in the house party. With I don't remember.
Okay.
Art Linkletter?
Oh, you're right.
Age. So,
ask
research
this question.
Yes.
This question,
the
which
research
is...
research and development...
branch of Calvo's...
And Damien's...
In the house
Club, right.
Is asked this question.
What is a Chippewa?
Sure, we've answered it before, but never with a pair of microphones staring us in the snoot and the old reel-to-reel running.
The reel-to-reel of running.
That's just the right thing for old people to think about, that reel-to-reel. We have one of those for our guests on the house party today.
In the house party.
But it's a digital reel-to-reel.
Oh, digital, of course.
And it isn't a trick question. It does have an answer. In fact, it has many answers, for a Chippewa is many things. In the world of quantum mechanics, for example, a Chippewa is an unstable elementary particle, so unstable that it falls over a lot, especially when bombarded with bombardons, those most bellicose of subatomic particles.
Bombardons. I like it. Is it an elementary particle? I thought it would have been an academic particle.
That's an academic party.
This is
a club.
Oh, this is a club.
Yes.
Right.
Two Chippewas are even less stable because they tend to pick fights with one another. These skirmishes are short-lived, however, and rarely approach the lethality that occurs when a Chippewa and an anti-Chippewa find themselves at the same party. Three or more Chippewas, which exist only in an artificial dimensional function universe, are known as a Feynman wave packet, smell vaguely of lemon, and mug shamelessly for nanophotographers. On the other hand, in the world of photocopying, a Chippewa is the microprocessor control that distributes the precise amount of the polymer mimeographite to each pixel to create a visible image. Invisible images, the bread, butter, and miracle whip of steganography, result from Chippewas that face backwards.
Excellent, excellent. I hadn't thought about that. I knew all about that before, but not the invisible.
No.
Oh, excellent.
Those two worlds aside, a Chippewa is also an intelligent carnivorous worm indigenous to Amazon.com rainforest. It is parasitic to humans, where it typically resides between the clavicle and humerus, causing rotator cuff neuralgia along with legions of local lesions. So be sure to seek medical succor at once if you think you have a Chippewa on your shoulder. Just pass that. In the deep south, which is farther south than most of us will ever venture, a Chippewa is the darling of the Barbacuminati.
Oh, start again.
In the deep south, which is farther south than most of us will ever venture, a Chippewa is the darling of the Barbacuminati.
Start again.
In the deep south, which is farther south than most of us will ever venture, a Chippewa is the darling of the Barbacuminati.
Better.
And consists of a bark-flavored liqueur drizzled over a plate of rice, chaff, and meringue. You'll know the dish is authentic if the peaks of the meringue resemble the famous igloo village of Took Tarmac Yak. Let's pause for a moment to take a stock of what a Chippewa is not. It is
no,
not.
No. We're
nope.
pausing.
Oh, sorry.
We're pausing.
Pausing.
Okay, what is it not?
It is not a topological gerund. It's not the bunghole in a button ocarina. It is likewise not the fifth star to the right of Kalahari in the constellation Vulcanola. Nor is it the part of the human genome into which a mosquito, given her druthers, will attempt to suck her blood-sucking proboscis. A Chippewa is a measurement of ancient time equal to 2 Rudyards, 50 planktons, or 200 cheap geysers. Interestingly, and I know you'll be interested...
I'm interested. I'm here with the tip of my geyser.
There is no known correlation between a plankton and a ship geyser, aside from the absence of leaves.
Oh, the ship geyser became a ship geyser. Excellent.
Yes. A Chippewa is also a metamorphic rock found in whales. Krillologists cannot agree as to how it got there. Some think it proves that whales once called volcanoes home, or at least picked up their mail there. Others believe the rock is metaphoric and actually symbolizes something else, such as a rud yurt. Still others are urging us to leave the land of metamorphosis post-haste and get on to the next category, comfort food. If you were to deconstruct a blancmange, you'd wind up with a puddle of milk, an argumentative clot of cornstarch, and enough sugar to temporarily blind a blowfish. Oh, sure, you'd also find trace amounts of vanilla extract.
No, I wouldn't, because I'd already have taken it out.
Cinnamon.
I like it.
Oh.
But I don't like the blancmange.
And a lemon peel that has lost its mind. But forget about all those ingredients for the moment. We're more interested in the neurotoxin found in the blowfish's liver. The poison derives from gram-negative bacteria that are reputed to speak 6 different languages, one of which is Chippewa. If that isn't comfortable enough for you as foods go, consider the avocado. I'll wait.
Oh, please, I don't want to consider the avocado.
I'm waiting.
It is green, it is gets dark, it looks khaki inside, and it's all gush.
This friendly fruit...
Not friendly fruit.
With flesh the color of sputum...
That's better.
...gets its name from avo, meaning 8, and kado, meaning ocarina. In the pantheon of whale mythology, the 8th ocarina is the title given to Chippewa, the goddess of blowholes. According to Belujo whisperer T. Chesterwing, many whale songs contain references to avocados. This claim could not be verified, since no one else has ever been found who speaks whale. Still considering, are we?
I've given up.
Very well.
I'm like the audience. I'm gone.
Here's one more example. The toga...
He won't stop!
The toga dolorosis, an ancient Roman cocktail devised by Pliny the Elder and first served to the great three-armed gladiator of Thebes, Chippewa, who said it tasted a bit metamorphic. There's more, of course. The word Chippewa has important connotations in the hair loss industry, 20th century jousting scholarships, cologne for lion tamers, devitrification art, the abattoirs of left-handed jingle salesmen, imaginary fourth-dimensional loci in vector space, and the design of Adobe hats. It even plays a role, and how's this for a coincidence, in this 553rd iteration of Calvo's Ampersand Damien's radiophonic program, now recontextualized as an architectural offering, for we're about to open the big door and invite a real live Chippewa, no relation to the Barbadon, to join us in the house.
To join us where?
In the house.
Breathe by Jeff Chippewa, interspersed with Filiana Bolero by Dennis Bathory Kitts.
Oh, we're on Canadian daylight time.
We are on, yes, a Canadian dollar time.
Yes. Looney time.
It's Calvos and Damien
in the house.
Out of the house.
I was almost to say on the road, but we're
on
not.
On the road. We're on,
out of the house,
the
in the house, on the road.
We're actually under the road.
Oh, hmm.
Hey, that's true.
We are three that's levels true. Down. From
and our car is parked 12 levels down. Over
13.
There.
13. No, it was 13. E13, whatever that is. I think they were speaking in metric.
Yes. I also understand Kilo that feet. There was a water main flood here recently, which means if it happens again...
We'll just run. Duck and cover.
Well, no, the car.
Oh, that. Oh, dear.
Where are we?
Where? And why?
We're in the lowest level of the EV building of Concordia University in Montreal. In the Black Box Theater, which is a research space run by Hexagram in Montreal.
And Hexagram is whom?
This is a group of people from different universities in Montreal that have come together, made this sort of association with each other, and they do research in various spaces in the university. So it's sort of an inter-university research collective.
Do they do it concordantly, or is there some animosity amongst the different...
You find that in Montreal anyways. Comes with the territory.
You were mentioning...
So you have to name it Concordia in order to bring people together. Yes. If you don't, they won't believe you.
No, this is not a harmonic Concordia.
Concordia.
We're here with our guest today, Jeff Chippewa, who is a world traveler these days. Recently in Berlin and now back here in Montreal for a while, just for this event?
For this and for some other work that we need to do with the CEC, which...
Yeah. The circus sounds in the background are set up for today's event. Mm-hmm. Why don't we start with what this is, why we're here, and then we'll get to you.
Yeah. Today we're having the official public launch of CAP, the Concordia Archival Project, which is a project the CEC has been coordinating over the past year and a half.
And the CEC is?
I have to remember to all the acronyms.
It's the
Canadian Electroacoustic Community. And so we've been, we had this project, a large project, where a number of tapes, a number of pieces on various analog formats from the 70s, 80s, have been digitized and made available publicly. So today is the public launching of the event. We're going to have...
Wine and cheese?
Coke and chips.
Okay.
And so we have sort of a half press conference, half information session for people in the community. So it's an open thing that people can just come in, and we'll tell them what the project is about, who's involved, what the different components are.
Well, try again. That.
And then we have a short concert afterwards with some works from the collection.
And the collection involved what kind of artists? Not the genre, but rather some of the people that we know.
There's a broad range of people. I mean, the people that you know from the Quebec scene, going back to the 80s and further, Marcel Deschaine, Francis Daumont, all the names that you'll recognize in concert programs and various things. There's also people who were simply associated with the university, some students, so early works as they were finishing their degrees are part of the collection, works from all over the world that have been sent in for different concert series that Kevin Austin had coordinated in the 70s and 80s.
When we interviewed years ago some Canadians from Toronto, there was an amazing number who studied in Victoria.
Victoria?
Yeah, isn't that correct? Am I saying? Yes?
I think that's right.
On the island. Yes. And
this is a different island.
It is, but I wondered if that connection was to Montreal or was it just unique to Toronto? They had all gone.
There's a question with Toronto and West, and there seems to be not so much a connection between Toronto and East.
They're simply two sort of the two largest cities in Canada, so typically you'll have this sort of not necessarily an animosity, but there's a belief that we in Montreal we have everything we need, and it's not much of a conscious attempt to really be informed and involved in the community in Toronto, which is also 6 hours away. Mm-hmm. Short jaunt in Canada. But
well, it's certainly Montreal has an incredible reputation for its electroacoustic music. And how did that happen?
I think it just built up over the years with the various people who were involved in it. There were some very strong figures. And
we're waving at the tourists as they're passing by, just making comments on the on the interview. Birds too.
Yeah, we're in the zoo now. Getting distracted with people coming in here.
Did it just grow? We're
usurped by Austin.
Voici Kevin Austin qui est ici pour déranger nos efforts.
Déranger, monsieur. Déranger.
Avez-vous un toilette pour Mankato?
Oui.
Oh, merci. Bon, très bien. Oui. Très bien.
We were being serious. That's the end of that. But how did Montreal become the center of electricity? Because it really is. I mean, it's kind of, in many ways, the North American center for it, because you don't see it in New York. You don't see it in Chicago. Maybe a little in Atlanta. But really here, if you're working in electroacoustics in North America, here's where you go. And how did that happen?
Well, there are a number of centers throughout North America, but... I guess what you could say is that it's the most concentrated center of activities, and it is quite large, and there are also four different schools that teach it here, and there are sometimes very, very divergent aesthetic interests and types of schooling. So you have Montreal as a city is sort of the confluence of North America and Europe, so North Americans that come to Montreal enjoy the European feel, and the Europeans that come here sort of enjoy the that it's not Europe and it's got this North American feel, but it's sort of halfway between. You've got the influence of all these different communities, so there's a lot of also from the French tradition. There's a lot of people who have been very important in developing the scene here. So Marcel Deschamps, Francis Daumont, and these people have been very, very strong figures in the scene here, and through their students and subsequent generations, it's simply built up and reinforced itself over the years. And I think that maybe because there's been this diversity, it's part of what's made Montreal this important center. Like I say, you have it elsewhere, but the communities might be smaller.
Right, they seem to be smaller.
More disjointed.
I mean, you'd think of New York as a major center for the arts, but you don't think of it when you think of electroacoustics. You think 500 miles wide.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with it? Now, you're involved in more than one way, because you write acoustic music as well as electroacoustic music. How did your involvement start?
Almost by accident. I had a sort of part-time position with the CEC in about 96 or something, and then I was going back to school at that time to complete my studies, and simply got more and more involved in it, and got involved in some of the projects, helped out on projects, whether it was just doing production and this sort of thing. And then every once in a while, we had a position that would come up. So we had a training position that Eve and I worked on. That's where I met Eve, Eve Gigon, who also is administrator with me. And I was involved with the CEC off and on over the years in various projects on PEP, the production, electroacoustic production, electro productions. To get my names right, if I'm gonna be taken seriously.
Oh, we don't want that.
And then in 2005, Ian Chopran, the previous administrator, moved on to other things for family, personal, professional reasons, and I was invited to move in and do what I could. And so since then, I've been co-administering the CEC with Yves Gigon.
And in terms of your compositional work, how did that start? Did you start out as sort of a rock and roll teenager who discovered electronics that way? And there's always a break point for someone where they suddenly realize that they can work in a given area successfully.
I don't think there was a breaking point other than me sort of... There wasn't a day where I woke up and said, this classic, I'm a composer. as of this, let me finish my coffee and I'm a composer. No, for me it was just over the years I just realized it was being creative and creating things. Whether it was in early activities, I did play in a rock band and played guitar and did all these things. And very early on, I started doing my own things and started making some multi-track things that I'm not going to let anybody hear ever. But there's always been an interest in sort of taking what I knew and learning new things and going further with it, and that just naturally led into creating pieces of various types. So with guitar, and then later using electroacoustics, and also with instrumental formations.
So what's a good piece that we should hear now?
Duo is probably the sort of, that's the fist in the teeth eye opener. It's an electroacoustic love song, actually.
Yeah. Let's hear. Our guest is Jeff Chippewa and Calvus and Damien
in the house.
And here it is, Duo.
Thank you.
Our guest is Jeff Chippewa. That was Duo.
We could do a sound walk while we do the interview, actually.
Oh, we could do that.
Yeah.
We could do that. We could. As a matter of fact, we could sort of replace a few things and move along. Well, let's do that in a little bit.
Sure.
Let's get on to sort of your...
Timbits influence?
What?
The influence of Timbits in his music?
Timbits.
Oh, Timbits.
You don't know what Timbits are.
You don't? You should.
I
thought they gave
you
were supposed to get you were supposed to get an information pamphlet at the border.
I was at the I was thinking of the bits part, the digital part, but I realized that Tim was the important part. Now I know the
centers
the
centers from the donuts.
Yes. What is your influence? what is the influence of Timbits on your work?
There's not much of one. I've never been a big hockey fan, and I've always felt ostracized because of that.
Oh. Well, didn't you do a piece with the hockey in it?
No, that was Kevin.
I see.
It's a piece called Hockey.
It's just background hockey noises.
And there's some bits of okay, yeah.
This is not said disparagingly. We'll say that to Kevin's face.
Yes, that's right, of course.
That was some Duo, actually, that just slipped into the background.
Mm. So you spent time elsewhere? Now you're in Berlin. You just happen to be here for this event.
Yeah.
But you've been living in Berlin. Have you been sort of like internationally studying and working and traveling? How's your career worked? Have you worked as a composer? Where have you gone? And then we're going to get to your notation stuff later. Let's go with the music first.
I was in Germany in 2002, 2003 for a year and a half. After I finished my studies in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I've always sort of gone around to different places just out of interest or sometimes out of boredom. And I went to Germany, to Freiburg, where Matthias Schwalinger was giving seminars. So I attended the seminars as a visitor, essentially, for a year and a half, so 3 semesters there. I was just interested in the scene there and the commitment of the musicians that you find and the the political involvement of the composers in Freiburg. There's a very, very strong scene there for, you know, it's not just a question of making pieces, there has to be some sort of purpose behind it, which is in some circles a bit of a radical idea. So I went there and spent a year and a half there, came back. I was back in Canada for a couple of years, floating about trying to figure out what I would do. Did residency in Banff, did another residency in Banff, and then moved back to Germany. And I've been there since 2006, so almost 3 years now.
Still in Freiburg?
No, this time I moved to Berlin. Berlin, right. Yeah, I moved directly to Berlin.
And so the question then comes, what do you do there?
We're looking for pointers.
Okay.
You can get those from the
You want
the
timbits of information.
Yeah.
I live there, and I work for the CEC from wherever I am. Everything is basically done through email communications, documents that are sent over the internet, Skype conversations with Eve, or this sort of thing. So I do everything that I would be doing anywhere. I just happen to be living in Berlin. Composing at the moment as well, getting back to that after my time is freeing up after this project. Uh-huh. And some other large projects that we had with the CEC over the past couple of years that kept me really, really busy. And also doing notation from time to time, which I took a break from to finish up a lot of this stuff for about a year. So
let's talk about that. I think it's a good point to sort of break and introduce our audience to the notion of notation and its importance. Mm-hmm. Because when we pretty much pick up a book, the text is an abstract for, the printing is an abstract for meanings. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of time spent except on some design subtleties. There's some good book designers, but that's really not in the forefront of how the book communicates. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to music notation, something very different happens. Can you kind of bring us into the world of notation and what its uses are beyond the communication of, say, a pitch or a position in time?
Well, of course, you have the sort of two-dimensional information on the score, which is the let's say, the pitch or the duration and this sort of thing. A lot of the rest of it has to come out of experience, I think, and out of proper presentation, proper representation of the music in the score to the performer, to the person who's going to be interpreting it. Because, of course, music is one of the most, for me, I've always found it a bit problematic that it's the one that has the most mediation between the actual creative act and the act of appreciating the work of art that was created. You have so many people that come in between that, the performers, the composer, how they write it out, how they interpret, reads that notation, what they understand of it, what's familiar to them, what's unfamiliar. So you have all these different levels of interpretation that happen that don't happen, for example, with painting, where the painter goes directly to the canvas, frames the thing themselves, and that's what you see in the gallery. Of course, you have the how it's presented in the gallery, all of that affects it. But in music, there's a much greater level of mediation between these sort of poles, let's say, of creation and appreciation of the work.
What is that content?
That depends on the piece. It depends on the composer. Because if you write,
well, this is important because when we, other than say a linguistic difference, from going from Spanish to English or Russian in a different alphabet or something like that, we don't encounter the kind of notational variety that you do in music. Can you kind of explore that for our audience, what these notational elements are, how they might differ, and why this is more of an importance here than it would be in simply picking up a novel?
You mean in the specifically the kind of stuff that I'm working on, or in notation in general?
Yeah, I think our listeners are familiar with picking up a score, that piano piece.
Yeah.
And they know what that looks like. It's symbols on a page, and they represent the pitches, they help position the fingers, and they represent kind of an abstract of duration and time, not a real duration, because a whole note, which at a slow tempo looks the same, pretty much as a whole note at a fast tempo, whereas, a fast tempo whole note might take less time than a passage of 16th notes at a slow tempo. All of these things, they're all sort of abstracts of pitch and rhythm. That's what most people are aware of, and of course orchestration if you're looking at a big score. But beyond that, there's a whole world of elements that particularly in the past 50 or 60 years have come into play.
Mm-hmm.
How have they changed things? How do you have to address those, not only as a composer, but also in your work, which is to produce a very fine and legible score?
We can simply say one of the things that's terribly obvious is that there's a much greater level of notated detail in the scores these days. There's also some very simple works. If you look at the works of Feldman, for example, they're incredibly simple. But if you play them without any level of interpretation, beyond what I was saying about this two-dimensional information, the note and the... there's no durations in some of the works by Feldman. For me, it's that there are symbols that represent certain things. So this is what an eighth note is, and this is what this F-sharp is, and it's in this register, and it's for this instrument, and all that is notated. But beyond that, there's also the context of the work. Who composed the work? A Chopin work you're going to perform fundamentally differently than a Liszt work, and fundamentally different than a Brian Ferneyhough piece for piano.
But
the
first two composers you mentioned use basically the same set of abstract symbols.
Ferneyhough does as well.
But
especially if you look at L'Ami et un Epigraphe, it's totally traditional and very romantic in some ways as well. It's a very, very romantic piece. It's a little more detailed than Chopin. But it has to do with the context. It has to do with the aesthetic values, the formal values of a given epoch as well. I also think in some ways that you people that perform Chopin or Beethoven today, in some ways aren't performing it properly either. I mean, we can never perform it properly. You don't know the context that existed back then, the listening context and the even the social values, the moral values of the time, all have to do with how people listened. The context of the concert was a hierarchy.
When you're dealing with the contemporary notation, though, very often you have new libraries of symbols.
Mm.
You have a different use of those symbols. For example, one composer might suggest that the size of a symbol changes the dynamic value that is played. That there are other ways of accomplishing, say, a cloud of sound. Chopin might have created a cloud of sound by an irregular set of irregular rhythms against each other, and they produce this beautiful rain sound or something. But in a contemporary piece, you might completely adjust the notation in a new way to accomplish that same effect. What has happened in the sort of library of symbols and in the way they are used?
On the one hand, there's been a lot of abuse. There are a number of symbols, and the thing is, the unfortunate thing is that you encounter, I've looked through thousands of scores in different places and from different stylistic areas, and you do find sometimes a dozen different symbols to indicate exactly the same thing, which could be indicated by one symbol, the way you have in what I call, without any negative, what I call Beethoven notation, the sort of most simplest notation with the durations, pitches, and this sort of thing. That sort of threw me off.
Just to remind our listeners, we are sitting here in this black box theater where things are being set up for for concerts and press conferences coming up.
I completely lost what I was saying.
You're referring to Beethoven notation, and there are things you understand or commonalities in that.
The abuse of...
Abuse,
right.
Yeah.
I think that there's a real need today. I think we're at a point where there could be a fundamental rethinking and reworking of contemporary notation to reduce it to its essentials, to say, well, to do this kind of thing on the instrument, this kind of sound, you should really use this symbol. And to try and find something that's throughout the whole range of possibilities somehow coherent. Because you have little bits of this person here decides to notate this thing this way, and it's a problem for performers. It's a problem for making sure that you're really performing the pieces properly. If the performer can't, dedicate their lives to learning 400 ways to notating,
right.
On a violin, there should be one. And we did some research and looked into this and started making a reduced set of things based on what existed, using some fundamental rules. You know, if there exists a symbol for something already and it's known amongst the performers, you should not make another one. Very seemingly logic things that are, you know, ignored a lot of times. And we found, of course, that there were some times where, well, this is the ideal notation, but then we found one or two cases where it really, really didn't work. So we think that a general reworking and reestablishment of the what am I trying to say? The word is, there's a word that's escaping me right now that is
Gâteau. Escaping all of us right now. We need one in the middle of the table.
There needs to be a fundamental rethinking and reestablishment of basically the foundation of new music notation. You establish these are how these things should be notated, and lists of exceptions and say, well, this is why this doesn't always work. So something that's not this sort of absolutist system that says, well, if you decide to write, you have to use this, but that it has to do with the context. Because you lose time. One of the things for me with notation, the most important thing has been to improve the contact that the musician has with the work. And I don't want the score to be an impediment to it. You know, I don't want the score to be something that they simply have to...
I'm looking at some of your own right now, and our listeners obviously can't see these, but I see in front of me not only a traditional symbology, but things that are unusual in their placement, a lot of descriptions, verbal descriptions on what's to be done. Are we in a phase where in order to play some of the pieces like yours, where we have, you know, arrows pointing to gestures and blank spaces rather than sort of traditional rests and unusual kinds of usages of glissando symbols and so forth? Are we in an area of transition where you're hoping that with the use of the material in a score like yours, because you're very, very detailed in how you create your scores, not just the music, but how it's represented on the page, are we in a period of time where composers are going to finally be able to take a deep breath and open, and in their learning process, open a book and learn these new notational symbols without having to invent them? Are we there yet?
I think so, but the documentation doesn't exist.
Are you working?
There are some classic texts for orchestration that you refer to, and there are differences between Samuel Adler and other orchestration books. I mean, there are differences between each one of them. Each one of them have their sort of peculiar interest in some ways. But there's a sort of a constant throughout them, and that had to do with a certain era where orchestration was one of the foundations of composition. This is something that you learned, and there were fixed approaches to writing particular types of music. I think people can, you know, sit down and you know, learn it. But I don't find amongst composers today, coming out of school, that there's a lot of effort being made in understanding of notation and the implications that it has on the performance.
Not when they have to think about finances and how to make a living.
It's time as well, I find. I mean, you know, composers are just so often right up to the last minute doing things, and then they never look back. Well, never, okay, that's a bit extreme, but it's very common that they don't necessarily look back and find all these incoherencies in their score that they've notated within the same piece, the same type of, you know, differently. So time needs to be spent on it, and it's taken me a lot of time to put on this, but the result is that when I go into a rehearsal with a musician, they don't ask me, what does this mean? Well, they ask me, why did you do that?
Okay. So
and as far as the one that we were looking at 1+5, the notation is in some ways very traditional. If you consider that notation in the 60s and 70s has become part of the tradition.
Has it?
Yeah. I mean, proportional notation is something that you can count on. You should not have to go into a rehearsal or send a score to a performer and think, ooh, I wonder if they know what proportional notation is, or I wonder if they know what a quarter tone is.
Well,
you shouldn't
ask that
question.
Our experience is that we still have that.
You do find that. You do find that, but I'm saying that shouldn't happen.
That shouldn't
and
happen.
The composer isn't the one that's wrong there.
Okay.
And I'm going to sound like a fascist composer in saying that, but in my experience, it's a question of the performers as well. And I don't want to, you know, crap on performers who are not willing to play my pieces. I don't want somebody to play my piece who fundamentally just wants to, like, play Liszt and Rachmaninoff. They don't want to play my piece, and I don't want to have them playing my piece. Mm-hmm. And if we come to terms with that, then, you know, we can go out and drink a beer together, but we just never have to deal with each other in a rehearsal.
We've discovered that the some of the younger generation musicians are more adept at reading new scores than more elderly folks who are
like us,
set in their ways and don't really want to take the time to learn new traditional or anti-traditional.
A new tradition.
I don't think it has to do with age, though. I'd say that it has to do with the fact that it's become much more common. I was speaking with Lucas Fels at one point, and he, the cellist from Ensemble Recherche, who's now with the Arditi, and before he was working with the Arditi, we were talking about, you know, performances of new music and all this, and he's just exasperated at hearing people complain that there isn't enough, you know, performances of new music, and he points out how many times, you know, Lachenminster stuff has been played by the Arditis, how many times Fernijo String Quartet has been played by the Arditis. I met with Stephen Schick. Well, I met him. I saw him at a concert and spoke with him briefly. And this was in 1999 or something like this. And at that time, he had six students studying Bone Alphabet by Fernijo, which is this unplayable piece. So times have really changed. Mm-hmm. There's a huge amount of new music being played. Art music is an elitist area of activity. I mean, any form of specialization is kind of elite in a way. There's the more and more specialized it is, the fewer people that are going to be interested in it. And if you have a problem with that, then you're always going to be struggling with these ideas. And if you can accept that, yeah, well, it's not for everybody. You know, I'm not going to pound my music down the throat of somebody who doesn't want to listen to it. I have trouble listening to it sometimes. So
we should play one of those right now, then.
Let's play something unlistenable.
Yes. What on earth might you have that's unlistenable? In a good way, though.
Well, I think it's all very listenable. I think, you know, Duo is a lovely electroacoustic ballad for me. It's a love song. It's an electroacoustic love song. But to really shift gears, we could listen to In Nomine.
Okay.
Which is for ensemble, so flute, oboe, clarinet, piano, percussion, violin, viola, cello, and massive amounts of objects and things that they have to use to produce sounds. And they actually, many of the performers play more on these objects and things than they do actually on their own instruments. The pianist has one note, I think, on the piano, and plays a number of other things. Scissors and paper,
rocks,
flag, walnuts, various other things.
Is this all strictly notated, or is there any room for improvisation?
I wouldn't call it improvisation.
Then we won't either.
What will you call it?
I call it a heightened degree of freedom of interpretation.
That puts a lot of onus on the performer.
We'll come back. Well, let's do it. We'll come back and ask you some questions about that. Our guest here on Cavils and Damien.
In the house and on the road
is Jeff.
Under the road.
Under the road.
Thank you.
It is. Yeah, I had these flashbacks of seeing this when I was a kid. They do these like drilling in his teeth or something.
Yeah, that's it.
What was it? Why did they drill his teeth? They were torturing him or something,
yeah,
weren't they?
Right.
But then they would let him go and run around in the city or something. So I never understood how, you know, I never understood how that worked.
Well, we'll bring in the drills for you. And we'll show you how that works.
I have to dentist. I don't want any more.
Yeah. That was In Nomine by Jeff Chippewa, our guest today. Objects. What were you talking about? We had a question. About
did we?
Yeah.
That was before we played this, and we were so discombobulated.
Improvisation, that was the question. I had a question. Why don't you like that word?
It's not that I don't like it. I have great amounts of respect for people that are improvising musicians. I've done improvised projects with other people as mm-hmm. well. Mm-hmm. I think the issue that I have is that for me, it's impossible to define a black and white line. You know, on this side of the line, it's improvisation. On this side of the line, it's composition. Because in any composition or improvisation, you have all these different levels of activity going on. And each of these levels have their own sort of degree of freedom, let's say, of interpretation, to use this, a bit of an excessive phrase. But so there's no composition or improvisation where all of these will align. Am I loud enough?
Yeah? Okay.
Okay. I can get closer. There's no piece, let's say, where all of these sort of different levels align in their degree of openness, how much the performer puts in and how much the composer has pre-notated and absolutely has to sound like this. So between these two poles of composition and improvisation, it's difficult to talk about it. I mean, I would say, well, this is a piece that leans more towards the composed side of things, and I say, well, this is a composition with some elements that allow a great degree of freedom to the to the performer. And other pieces where I'd say, well, there's bits of the pieces that are composed, but they leave great amounts of interpretation just completely free to the performer. And then there are, of course, projects which are specifically improvised, you know, whether it's based on concepts, you know, we go in and the form is sort of predefined in a sort of skeletal form, and we're going to do this, and this section has this, and then how you interpret all of that is done live, and other where you have completely free works of improvisation where it's not predetermined at all. You just go in, but there is a certain amount of determinate elements in it because you've been working with these people, or you've got your own bag of tricks. Bag of tricks, that sounds so cheap.
Well, that's what we do.
You know those improvisers, you know, they all got their own bag of tricks, you know, they just, you know, throw one thing out on the floor after another, and put the thing, they call it, like, you know, spontaneous composition or something like that, So I really don't have a problem with improvisation at all.
I was trying to get at how you distinguished it from, because when we first talked about a nominee, you said it's not improvisation or something to that effect. And at what point does it make that transition? Is this in some ways an artifact of the kind of bias against the word from the 60s when people talked about aleatory instead of that, because improvisation suggested, you know, something to do with jazz or pop music? And are we sort of suffering from that heritage, or do you really find a distinction that's clear? You said there's no clear line between composition and the contribution, the interpretation.
Well, for me,
what's
some
the
of that
line
the
between,
opposite.
You know,
but
yeah, what's the line when you can call it improvisation? How does that how does it differ?
I don't know.
Oh.
I don't have an answer for that. In the same way that there's, if I say that there's no specific place where a composition becomes an improvisation, then I can't really say, well, this is the point at which composition becomes improvisation, I guess. But in a nominee in particular, it's not a question of improvisation. Everything is really notated. Everything is there. There are some things that are a bit open. So, for example, there's a ruffling sound that clarinetist has to play, and they can choose. There are some sounds, let's say, sounds in quotation marks, that they have to find an object to make this type of sound for the piece. So I know what the sound's going to sound. You know what? If I say, well, there was this ruffling sound, everybody immediately has an image of what a ruffling sound is for them. And the same way the performers have their own image of what it is, and they find an instrument, they may listen to it and go, okay, that's interesting, and then the first rehearsal they realize, oh, that doesn't really work with any of this, so they'll choose another thing. So that's their contribution to it, but it's a ruffling sound. There's a crescendo and a decrescendo written over the entire duration, which is totally written out. So the fine details of the thing are not written out, you know, exactly what the dynamic is, how many decibels that the peak of the crescendo or something, like none of that is written out, but that doesn't make it, for me, improvisation. There are held notes that don't have a specific duration, but I mean, you have that in classical music as well. You have a fermata that's held, and it's an expressive fermata, let's say, at the end of a cadence to close the phrase off, and it has to do with how they performed what came before and how they decide to interpret the next section. So it has to do with the piece. It's written out, but the actual absolute duration is undefined. And for me, it's no different in Omine. With some other composers, it would be, for sure. That, you know, they'll have a different approach to, you know. But I think a lot of this stuff is actually very traditional. I don't think any of this is so radical.
No, what's the question of that? It's just trying to get at the notion of what contribution the performer does make. And I think the ruffling example is a really good one, because it would suggest that the performer has a certain level of commitment. Because they have to make that decision, rather than a director saying, you're doing this, you're doing this, you're doing this, and this is specified in the score. It's not the same.
There are objects that are really specified where I say you have to have an electric trimmer. And that's just it. You have to have a deck of cards because you have to do this thing. And there's some objects where I said the ideal object or the thing to make this kind of sound is this, and there I've defined it. In other cases, like the ruffling sound, it didn't matter. A cracking sound, a rattling sound, all of these kind of things. The performers can decide what they want to use for it. They do have a commitment. I mean, the pianist at the end of the piece, the last thing that the pianist does is to take a prepared sheet of paper with the entire alphabet written out on it and cut up into individual letters the entire sheet. So
this requires a special pianist, though, then, not someone who's, say, trained in Bach. I don't think he or she could do that.
No.
Maybe someone Cage.
That person could cut out B, A, C, and H.
Oh, right.
And make a musical event out of it.
Or you can make two sheets, and they could have a two-voice counterpoint.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, then what about Pachelbel?
No,
Pachelbel.
No?
I hate Pachelbel. No. Ausgeschlossen.
Nein!
So the thing is, that completely changes. If you have, I expected, you know, okay, come with a sheet, let's say 11 by 17, and the guy came with, 23 by 35, and had written, and so you hear, and you hear the transformation as the sheet gets smaller, all the way to the end. And the time is how long it takes. It depends on how they cut it. You know, if somebody just goes up in lines and then cuts across very quickly, and he really took the time and cut out each individual piece and was very, very concentrated and made a huge, it's, I think, 45 seconds or something, this phrase of 45 seconds as he cut out all the letters.
As time passes and the sort of first-person contact with the composer is broken. How can you imagine the performance of pieces like this will change, where you can no longer have an expectation that there will be an electric trimmer, or
it'll be a sampled sound from the past or something, when we all have epilation each morning.
I mean, you know, there are particularly. I mean, you know, this sort of heritage of sort of breaking free from the sort of the pitch rhythm notational system, which was really in a strong position for at least 200 years. How will we see these pieces during the transitional phase of, say, 1925 or so through the present? Performances change when that contact is lost with you, when you no longer are there to say, you know, that was a great idea with a big sheet of paper, but, you know, at the beginning it's problematic, or when some of these words fall out of meaning, as we understand them.
Well, it comes back to what we were talking about earlier with the importance of the notation, and if composers spend the time in the scores making things totally clear, that the piece really should be able to function without the composer. there's no reason that I shouldn't be able to send this to any ensemble and expect that they'll do their own interpretation. They might decide, well, I don't have an electric trimmer, so I'm going to use this, but I understand what the intention here is, and so it'll still function. Because you have to take it and press it against a piece of paper, so you get like this. And if you know what that is, I have no problem with a performer deciding to use some other machine that does the same sort of sound and has the same sort of gesture. That performer is going to understand it by the instructions. And so the instructions are very, very clear in my scores, and there is a lot of text in the scores, but it's also because I'm not writing out, let's say, sequences of notes or anything. I write a single note with a duration, a pitch in some cases. Once the score is ready, then I try and figure out some pitches for it.
Oh, there's a pitch here. Come and see. He's got a pitch right there.
So it really shouldn't be a problem. There's a lot of text. I've really put a lot of effort into minimizing the text, but there's a certain amount of text that's just essential to simply explain what has to be done here. And so if you can make it very clear without it being excessive, you know, like 2 pages of instructions. I mean, these Coggle scores are great for these kind of things sometimes. They're necessary, I think, in his scores, but I don't think my scores don't need to have that kind of...
Well, you do have at least one that I had here. I don't think I printed it out. It's a piece for piano tuning pegs, I think it was. You want to describe what that is?
It's a very simple piece that has a number of sheets that come up on scores. So there are 4 people that basically turn the pages for the audience. They're printed on 11 by 17 sheets. And they have different instructions about how and when to drop a piano tuning pin. So it's called for piano, square bracket parts. For audience, it's essentially the audience that performs the piece. And you need several hundred piano tuning pins or bullet cases or some similar thing, some cylindrical metal or something object that you drop on the ground according to the instructions on the score.
Now, do you have a recording of that?
Yes,
good.
Yes, okay. We do.
Well, let's hear that now, and we'll be right back. Our guest is Jeff Chippewa.